On Tisha B'Av, we draw our attention to two primary enemies of the Jewish people who destroyed respectively the first and the second Beis HaMikdash. The Babylonians, Bavel, and the Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash, and the Romans, who under Emperor Vespasian, his son Titus was a general. Vespasian started as a general and began the attack on Yerushalayim. The siege of Yerushalayim was completed by his son Titus, Titus, who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. That's the Romans. So the Babylonians and the Romans are the two enemies that we call our attention to on Tisha B'Av. And Rome, the name of the city, the very name of the city, and certainly the Roman Empire, represents in the eyes of Chazal and traditional Judaism the opposite of what we stand for. They simply sometimes refer to Chazal did as Romans as Malchus Harsha. Malchus Harsha, the wicked kingdom. Such a stanza in Moe's Tzur. Anyway, and it says it's easy to understand why. Because the Romans occupied Eretz Yisrael and ultimately destroyed it, including the Beis HaMikdash itself, Yerushalayim. And it was later the Romans who changed the name of Eretz Yisrael, Judea, originally to Syria, Palestina, taking the name of our ancient enemies, the Plishtim, the Philistines, and sort of corrupting a little bit and giving that name to land, Palestinians, which has its ramifications, obviously, to this day. And it was like almost like a taunt, a perpetual taunt at the Jewish people. And Chazal, furthermore, identified Rome with Edom and Esav. Now, genealogically or scientifically, that's somewhat questionable. Did the Romans descend directly from Edom, from Esav? So it's not our issue now. But certainly we know the Chazal's view of Esav. And there's a tradition that the day that the Bnei Yisrael built the golden calf is the day that the twins Romulus and Remus were born and established the city of Rome. So Rome is always the opposite of Eretz Yisrael. It's the opposite of the Jews. In fact, the Gemara says, I can't remember now if it's a Gemara, it's certainly a Medrash, that if somebody tells you that Caesarea, today it's a resort town with golf courses in Israel, but it's on the coast of the Mediterranean, Caesarea, Caesarea, but that was the Roman enclave, the Roman administrative capital of, they called at that time, Judea. If somebody tells you that Caesarea, meaning the Roman Empire, is intact and Yerushalayim is destroyed, believe it. If somebody tells you that Caesarea is destroyed and Yerushalayim is intact, believe it. But if someone tells you that both are destroyed and both are intact, do not believe it. And this goes back, perhaps, to the original Nevuah, the prophecy that Rivka Imenu received when she had the twins inside her. Olom v'olom yamatz, there'll be a constant struggle between the two children, Yaakov and Esav, symbolizing the Jewish people and the Romans, according to Chazal. And so, the fact is that Rome conjures up negative things in the eyes of, in the minds of the Jewish people. But I'd like to look today, for the time that we have, a little bit at the city of Rome itself and the Jews in Rome. Jews have lived in Rome for over 2,000 years, longer than any other European city, and really longer than anywhere else outside of Eretz Yisrael. And if you talk about continuous Jewish population, understand that there were times when Jews could not live in Yerushalayim, and Jews were banned from place in Eretz Yisrael, so Rome has a distinct longevity record in terms of a Jewish population in Rome. Jews came to Rome long before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. There are different estimates, but sometime between the 4th and the 1st centuries BCE, we know that Jewish people came there for economic reasons. There are some estimates that at some point, again, historians question this, we don't have accurate records, but at some point, we're talking before the Churban, before the Churban was in the year 70 of the Common Era, so we're talking an earlier stage, maybe there were 7 million according to some records. Again, these numbers have been challenged, and I'm certainly not qualified to paskin on that question. But whatever, it is a significant number of Jews, and the first report of Jews going that we have on record is in 161 BCE. Jews came at the, according to one presentation, at the direction of the advice of Yehuda Maccabee. And we know, of course, from the Hanukkah story, Judas Maccabeus, right, the leader of the Jews and the Jewish generals in the time of the Hashmonaim, the Hanukkah story. And they were there as envoys of Yehuda Maccabee. Most certainly, Most certainly, there's more definitive records even, but a few years later, in 139, that was 161 BC, BCE, the numbers go down, right? So in 139 BCE, a number of years later, there are other people who were sent by Shimon. You know, there were five brothers, as we know, in terms of the Maccabees. So Shimon the Maccabee, who was the leader at that time, sent a group of messengers to Rome and emissaries to Rome in order to strengthen the position of the Hashmonaim against their enemies at that time, the Greeks. So the Seleucid Greeks, just for a point of view of just this history to understand, you know, after the time of Alexander the Great, the Greek Empire, so after he died, his successors were not able to hold the empire together. The empire is split into initially three and ultimately two parts. One part was based in Egypt, and it was called the Ptolemaic Kingdom because the kings were called Ptolemy. We have in the Gemara, Ptolemy HaMelech. The Ptolemaic Empire was based in Egypt, in Alexandria. And then it was the Seleucid Empire, which was based in Syria, okay, in the Damascus, in that area. Those were two branches, so to speak. They were Greeks. That's why when you hear Hanukkah, remember as a kid, you're growing up, you hear, who was the enemy exactly, Hanukkah? Sometimes, depending who taught, it was the Greeks the enemy, the Syrians were the enemy, the Syrian Greeks, the Greek Syrians. What's going on with all that? Right? I mean, the Greeks are not Syrians, you know. I have my mother, Lashem, had an uncle, Zimala Rocha, was a Rav in a community outside of the New York area. And apparently there was a large Greek delegation in that town, a large Syrian, not Jewish, I'm talking about, you know. And during the Hanukkah season, which is the holidays, you sometimes have to speak at some sort of a council, you know, and tell a little bit about the Jewish holiday that's coming up. So depending who the mayor was, he had to say who the enemy was, the Greeks, the enemy was the Syrians. So had to walk a careful line. But in any event, there were Syrian Greek is correct, because it was the Syrian branch of the Greek Empire. Antiochus, the villain of the Hanukkah story, known as Antiochus IV, so he was, the Seleucid, called the Seleucid Empire in the north. Anyway, so that was the enemy Hanukkah time the Hashmonaim fought, and they appealed to Rome for assistance, according to this, in 139 BC, and that's when Jews came, or a significant number of Jews came as an emissary, but there were already Jews there. There were already Jews there. We have a record of actually an expulsion of Jews who were not Roman citizens from Rome. Apparently people used to go there, and there's a record also in 139 BCE of Jews who were not citizens being banned from the city, which means that there were Jews who were citizens who were there, who were allowed to stay. So bottom line is that a Jewish presence existed in the city of Rome quite, you know, several centuries before the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Again, people came for economic reasons. People seem to have come from Alexandria, which is in Egypt, which you can come by boat, you know, across the Mediterranean. So, and became citizens of the Roman Empire in Rome and elsewhere in the Roman Empire as well. As I said, the fact that there were expulsions of Jews means that there were Jews who were living there. Otherwise, we wouldn't have to expel them. So, what was the relationship? Well, it appears that some of the Roman emperors, including some of the famous ones, as we'll see, were favorable towards the Jews. They found the Jews to be strange. You know, they found the Jewish practices odd. They viewed them as a backward kind of people. But certainly anti-Semitism, as we know it later, from the Christians and so on, did not exist at that point. They recognized the antiquity of the Jews' religion. They recognized the fame of the temple in Jerusalem. Of course, Herod, who was a Roman, rebuilt the temple, the models of the second Beis HaMikdash that we see today. If you go to Yerushalayim, you see all these, you know, exhibits and so on and so forth, and films and pictures of what it looked like. You know, that was after Herod refurbished it, and so he made it into a beautiful, beautiful building and so on. So the Romans respected that as well. They didn't know much about Judaism, and said that the Emperor Augustus thought that the Jews fasted every Saturday, that their Sabbath was a day of fasting. He never had a chance, you know. But that's what they thought. They didn't know much about the Jews, about the Jewish religion. Julius Caesar, around 50 BCE, said, "We are sorrowed to hear that decrees have been issued against our friends, the Jews, which makes it impossible to live for them to live according to their ancestral customs." And so there were Roman leaders who were very sympathetic towards the Jewish population, whether they understood them or not. Now, around the year 63 BCE, the Roman general Pompey conquered Jerusalem, and there was a mistake was made. The descendants, without going into details now, the descendant of the Hashmonaim, the original Hashmonaim, Yehuda Maccabee, the brothers, the earlier generations were, Ramban Chumash calls Chasida Elyon, great pious people. Unfortunately, things deteriorated in subsequent generations to the point that, forget about, you couldn't call them Shomrei Torah Mitzvahs by any stretch of anyone's imagination. They were scoundrels. And there was a civil war at one point that broke out between two brothers, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. Again, generations already had Roman names, and Greek names, and they were further down the line. And to resolve the civil war, they brought the Romans in to help. Well, when the Romans came in, they didn't leave. Okay, so basically in 63, Pompey conquered Yerushalayim, and the Romans deposed the Hasmonaim dynasty altogether. The Gemara says that anybody who claims to be descendant of Hasmonaim is for sure not Jewish. Right? It's for sure not Jewish, because there were no descendants anymore. The Hasmonaim family was done away with, was wiped out. And Herod was appointed, you know, king of the Jews in about the year 40 BCE, and the land became called the Roman province of Judea in the year 6 of the Common Era. So that's, you know, again, you know, the background. But there were Jews, as I said, who were living in Rome. The Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria wrote in the year 40 CE, he said the Jews had certain guarantees from the Emperor Augustus beforehand. He permitted them to send their taxes to Jerusalem. They were allowed to pay their tax again. The space center still stood at that point. And Jews who would get their monthly grain ratio, if the day that it was given out on, was on Saturday, was on Shabbos, he gave them permission to come the next day and get it. So there were, there were positive things. In around 90 CE, Josephus writes that Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, Augustus, and Claudius gave the Jewish community certain rights and benefits and privileges and so on. They were exempted from military service. So there was a positive approach towards the Jews at certain points. However, there was another expulsion of Jews from Rome by the Roman Emperor Claudius. Actually, there's a reference to it in the New Testament. Okay, not the details, but the New Testament speaks in the book of Acts. If I look it up, I can give you the passage. It speaks about Paul, and it says, after this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. So there we have a reference in the New Testament to the fact that at some point, all Jews were told to leave Rome. Clearly, when the wars, which resulted in the Churban, you know, starting around the year 66 or so of the Common Era, Churban is, we assume, 70 CE, culminating with the Bar Kokhba, and that situation about 50, 60 years later, more than that, 135 CE, all of this strained, shall we say, relationship between the Jews and the Romans. In Rome, though, the community was organized. Many of the Jews who lived there were not religious. They were Hellenized Jews. They were secular Jews. But there were Jews who lived there. There were shuls. And we do have actual tombstones, which I'll get back to in a moment. I was in Rome a few weeks ago. I didn't see them. We can go to the area called the catacombs. Apparently it's closed off. And generally, you have to have special permission to get there. Well, I'll get back to that in a moment. But as a result of this, and it's interesting because you can tell, I mentioned the kinnis this morning, the symbol of a Jew, nowadays, I think on a tombstone, the symbol of Jew is usually a mug and David. You know, if it doesn't have anything else written there, they put a mug and David. What a mug and David is and what the origin of that is for another time. But it's very questionable and how early, not too early at all. In the olden days, it was a menorah. It was a menorah. It was a symbol on the tombstone. And so there are old stones, you know, and so on there that have menorahs on it, indicating that these were Jews. But basically, the experience of the Jews kind of fluctuated depending on who was the emperor. Again, the revolt, did not do anything for good relations because Jews did have loyalty and they were paying taxes, as we said before. Their tax money went to Jerusalem. However, that was changed under Vespasian, and something called the Fiscus Judaicus was a tax that Jews had to pay in the Roman Empire to Rome. That replaced the tithe that was, you know, that allowed them to send money to Jerusalem. Of course, we know that Titus, who was a general, took over for his father when his father became the emperor, took over as the general, and he's he who destroyed the city of Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash and so on. And we're all familiar with the famous Arch of Titus that has a carved out depiction of Jews, or of people carrying the menorah and a couple of the other Klei HaMikdash. The Chatzotzos can be seen, part of the Shulchan can be seen on that fresco, and it's still there. It looks exactly like you see in the pictures, and that was built in honor of Titus. The original inscription was supposed to read as follows: "The Senate and the people." This is dedicated to the Senate and the people of Rome, to Emperor Titus, father of the fatherland. There, Caesar, who with the help and advice of Vespasian subdued the Jews and destroyed the city of Jerusalem, which before him had withstood the onslaught of generals, kings, and peoples. That was the original description. Some people felt that a briefer text would be more appropriate, and it's not exactly the text that we have there. But anyway, we do have the Arch of Titus, and you know it has survived. Do we know what happened to the menorah and to the chatzot? We don't. And there are all kinds of theories. Many assume today it's not in the Vatican. We don't know. Okay, well, I'll leave it at that. I certainly don't know. Anyway, so this is the depiction of the Roman in Rome of the so-called Arch of Titus. I have with me, I'll pass it around, a coin which was put out in Eretz Yisrael. The depicting the ancient coin is an ancient coin which the Romans minted at the time of the conquest of the of Eretz Yisrael, the destruction of Beis Hamikdash, which has, it's hard to see, but I'll pass it around, has a picture of a Roman standing by a tree and a Jew sitting, like on Tisha B'Av, sitting mourning under the shade of a tree, and the Roman sort of lording it over, and it says, Judea Capta, which means Judea has been captured, or Judea has fallen. In Eretz Yisrael, in 1948, they minted another coin with the same tree, and a woman holding a baby, proudly, and a person planting another tree. So the Israeli coin, which I picked up there. So on the one side, it says, it's very hard to read it, but it says that Yehuda HaShvuya captured Jerusalem, which was in the year 70 CE. On the other side, it says, Yisrael HaMshuchreres, right? Israel has been freed. So if you want to pass this around, hold the coin. It's not that exciting, but if you want to see it. Anyway. Now, one of the things which the Emperor Vespasian, before he became emperor, before he left Jerusalem, did was he allowed the Jews to have Jewish leadership in the city of Yavne, Tein Yavne Chachamel, so the Sanhedrin was in Yavne and so on. But we do find in the Gemara people who traveled to Rome, okay, I mean Rabbanim, who traveled to Rome to plead the Jewish case to various other things, so and were prominent. There was a certain Rav Masya who was known to have been in Rome, okay. There was an interesting person called Tudus Ishromi, a Talmud Chacham, who lived in Rome, Tudus Ishromi. The Gemara talks about him, and apparently people still brought some form of a Korban Pesach, and he had various details of the Machlokas of the Korban Pesach. I won't go into the halakhic details, but it's, you know, he's mentioned as you know, in the Gemara he's called Tudus Ishromi. Okay, you know, again, a Jew living in Rome at that time. So we certainly have references in the Gemara to it. When Marcus Aurelius was the emperor, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai came together with Elezer, Rabbi Yossi, to the emperor to plead the case of the Jewish people for leniency and so on. In fact, the Gemara says that that's part of the origin of the idea that some of the Kelim and the Mikdash are there. One of the Tanaim went to Eretz Yisrael and said, I saw there's a question in the Gemara about what the tzitz, the Kohen Gadol's golden forehead plate, had the word Kodesh Lashem written, the words Kodesh Lashem written, that says in the Torah. But the question of Gemara, exactly how you write it, with the two lines, and without the details now, because Tisha B'Av, Gemara and Sukkah discusses what, how the letter, how the word should be written. And one of the times, well, I was in Rome, I saw it. Right? So he describes, so we have descriptions of Rabbanim going to Rome. Apparently in the time of Marcus Aurelius, they came, and apparently his daughter was very sick, and one of the Rabbanim was able to cure her. So, you know, they felt there was a positive relationship. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, the Gemara quotes, Yeshua ben Levi, really remarkable. The Gemara says that he was in a dream. He saw the Mashiach sitting on the outskirts of Rome, as if that's where he's going to come from. Right? He was sitting on the outskirts of Rome. Again, what does that mean exactly? But Rome figures in rabbinic literature. Okay, there's also a medrash in Dvarim Rabbah, which describes an interesting legend, exactly story, that the Jews, an important Roman senator, actually converted to Judaism. Now that itself is interesting, but there is a record in non-Jewish literature. Cassius Dius, the Greek historian, wrote that in the time of the Emperor Domitian, a prominent Roman senator and his wife were kicked out of Rome because of their sympathy to the Jews. Is this the guy that the Medrash is referring to? I don't know, but it's interesting. And I spoke before about the catacombs. It just so happens that a number of weeks ago, about a month ago by now, Rabbi David Lau, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi now in Eretz Yisrael, so he was in Yeshiva University in YU, and he had lunch with this yeshivas. I was there. He was talking about having been in Rome a couple of months ago. He got, okay, he's a chief rabbi. He got permission to go to these catacombs, and he went there, and, you know, there were graves there which he said seemed to come from before, you know, the destruction of Beis Hamikdash, which means you had Jews there who saw the Beis Hamikdash, who buried Jews, buried there, they saw the Beis Hamikdash. Remarkable. But he said the catacomb, and we know that there are catacombs there. I asked about, when I was there, I asked about the catacomb. I'm not the chief rabbi, so I was going to get permission to go there. But the guy told us that, he told us, you have to get permission and so on and so forth. You have to make a special appointment. They bring people there to these catacombs, and you can see that there are differences. There are catacombs in many, many Christians Romans buried there also, but you can tell which is a Jewish area that was set up differently and so on. And the tombstones actually indicate where people come from. So just read, this is a book, there's a book called The Pope's Jews. It's the Jews of Rome, right? Called by Sam Wagenaar from, published a quite a number of years ago. According to this, original published, was publication originally in 1974. Okay. Anyway, so, is that still called the number? Yeah. Anyhow, so, just to get an idea, he describes some of the inscriptions in these catacombs, okay? And some of the people were well-to-do. It tells what their job was and so on, the butchers and then builders, okay, bankers, okay, all kinds, not everything was with a B, but just he mentioned a bunch of different things. He said one of them, one of the inscriptions says, no one is immortal. Okay, that's a good thing to put in your tombstone, right? And another one says, even the departed have the power of love, okay? Another one, a sausage maker, a good man, friend of all, who lived for, another person lived for 85 years and didn't live as long. Okay, a certain man named Asteria, an Orthodox and blameless head of the synagogue. Doesn't say which synagogue. Okay, and the other one was Menophilus, father of the synagogue of the Carcharegians, who lived well as a Jew, who spent 34 years with his wife and witnessed his grandchildren. So again, these are inscriptions you can see apparently in these catacombs. Okay, now. Things changed in early 300s, 313, when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire. Originally, the Roman was pagans like everybody else. The Christian religion caught on, then the Emperor Constantine, okay, in the year 313, the so-called Edict of Milan. And the position of Jews in Italy and Rome and elsewhere understandably deteriorated at that point because they were not Christians. And for had now, it doesn't mean they were persecuted all the time. They were not. Many of the, even the popes didn't really care about it, but there was a temporary respite under a Roman emperor known as Julian the Apostate. And he was called the Apostate because he didn't accept Christianity. So he was called Julian the Apostate. He was positive towards the Jews. And in a letter addressed to the Jews, he wrote, I have seen a great deal of your misery, of which I learned even more when I found the registers which were used against you. I have thrown these registers into the fire so that such an infamous tax can no longer be collected. Thus you will live untroubled in all parts of our lands, enjoying peace, and you will address even more fervent prayers in favor of my emperor to your almighty creator and God. He's talking about the tefillah, l'shalom ha'peis in the corner, the tefillah l'shalom ha'medina, so to speak. They wanted the Jews to pray for him and so on. So that was Julian the Apostate. Things were good under him, but that was the successors were Christian, and again, didn't last very long, this good period under Julian the Apostate. Now, nonetheless, even after the Roman Empire fell, so it was taken. Italy was taken over for about 200 years in the mid 500s and mid 700s by the Lombards, and Jews were able to live in peace and lived relatively well under those years. Okay, it was not until a little bit later, okay, when certain of the popes, who sometimes tolerated the Jews and didn't cause them any trouble, but certain popes turned things around. The Pope Gregory, known Christian circles, Gregory the Great, in 590, under him, things were pretty good. Okay, it says that from 590, during his 14 years, he sat on the throne of St. Peter, that's in the Pope, life was easier for the Jews. He said, quote, we must gain the Jews' confidence and support through our kindness, our love and benevolence, our earnest appeal. Threats and violence only will alienate them. And again, we forbid to vilify the Jews. We allow them to live as Romans and to have full authority over their possessions. So again, there were people who were positive in terms of the Jews. However, as I said before, not everyone was, and things were bleak under others. Okay, as time went on, okay, and again, I'm going through 2,000 years in one hour, so can't cover everything. But there were various catastrophes that were blamed on Jews. That was the typical approach. In the year 1017, a violent storm raged through Rome, and the Pope and the citizens were in despair, and someone had a great idea. It was the Jews' fault. Okay, well, that idea, of course, caught on, and there were persecutions and so on, and, that did happen. Although, interestingly, when many Jews were killed based in the 1300s, the so-called Black Plague, the Black Death, that the Jews did better within Italy and in Rome than in other places. Jews were burned all over Europe, actually, in Italy, the Pope at that time, and the Pope were good men, Clement VI, okay, he protected the Jews. So, again, there were times, good times and bad times. In terms, just to get a flavor, just in terms of, there's actually one story about a pope who had Jewish blood, a Jewish pope. Okay, I won't go into that the story right now, but there was a person who came from a Jewish background, who came from Jewish grandparents and so on, and there are various legends about him in Jewish circles. One is that this pope became, you know, the Jew. Eventually, he had been captured or taken, it was hidden or whatever it was, and he eventually became the pope, but he remembered his parents. According to one legend, a boy was stolen again by Christians, and a lady had him baptized, and eventually he ascended to become the pope, even though he realized he was different, maybe because of his bris, or whatever it is, he realized difference, and he remembered a little bit about his house, and apparently some rabbi came to the town, and apparently he got an audience with the pope, and the pope was supposed to be a very good chess player, and this rabbi was a good chess player, so he set it up that they should play each other and met each other. Daddy! That's a legend. I don't know if it's a true story. Okay. Anyway, but there were, again, good times and bad times. In terms of rabbinic authorities, one of the great among the Rishonim was the Rav Nosson, the author of the Aruch, really before Rashi. We find that Sefer Aruch is, in effect, a dictionary of Talmudic lingo, I guess would be the best way. It's available. I have it home. It's not a rare Sefer. Okay, you can, Aruch basically translates words of the Gemara, and Rashi will sometimes quote the Aruch, so he was living in Italy, and there were other significant Jews who were famous. Later in the 1200s, you have people in the Ditrani family. You may have heard of the Tosus Rid, Reish Yodalad of Yeshaya Ditrani is his name, and the second of Yeshaya, sometimes called Riaz, Yeshaya Achron, the second of Yeshaya, and Zion is anyway, so there were Jewish scholars from Italy as well. Again, under other popes, the situation was very bad. For example, in the early 1200s, the pope threatened with excommunication anybody who placed or maintained Jews in public positions. Okay, and every Jew who was holding office should be dismissed from such office. And it was at that time that it was decreed for the first time among many that Jews had to go in the street wearing a special badge or star. The Nazis did not invent that. Okay, contrary to popular, the Nazis did not invent the yellow badge. You had that back then in other places, including in Italy and Rome. Sometimes it was yellow, sometimes it was red, sometimes half white and half black, but it was something that people, Jews, had to wear to be recognized in the street at that time. There were also different occasions when there were public burnings of Jewish Sfarim. Okay, in 1239, 1244, 1265, 1285, public burnings of the Talmud in Italy. Okay, but just to give you an idea, from 1000 to 15, the year 1000, the year 1555, there were altogether 98 different popes. So it's, and including what they call the anti-pope, again, those who know there was a split in the Catholic Church. There were two popes, again, I won't go into that now, but there were, 98 different popes. And some of them were good people, had good relations, and there were records of Jews presenting a copy of the Sefer Torah when the new pope came and became, or were incarnated, whatever, initiated into the Jews, and they gave, whatever happened, so we're not sure. But anyway, so there were a number of different popes who were good and others who were bad. It's really as simple as that. In one of the more favorable popes was called Martin V. Martin V. When he became the pope, he had positive things to say about Jews. He said as follows: "The Jews, in their blindness, remain stubbornly opposed to the words of the Holy Writ, which would make them accept the Christian belief. Yet we do not want to keep our Christian love from them, so they may understand their mistake and come to recognize the true light of love, who is, I won't say in the shul, but we know they're talking about." So some of the benevolence towards Jews was motivated by missionary reasons, or hopefully you're nice to the Jews, they'll see we're such nice guys, they'll want to join us. You're going to persecute them, okay? They're not going to come to our religion. And he also criticized the Christians who had forfeited the right to be called such, because many of them did everything in their power to oppress the Jews. So he criticized the Christians who. So again, under these different popes, things were better or things were worse. Again, some of his successors, Martin's successors, were positive. Jews had success in different professions. All right, there were Jews who were successful in medicine, in banking. Again, we know that the Jews were in banking because the Christians couldn't lend with interest and so on. But Jews were merchants. Jews were successful merchants. One of the reasons Jews were successful merchants is, like today, wherever you go, you meet somebody, right? I mean, right? The Jews, wherever you go, you run into somebody, and by the time you finish talking, you were in camp together, right? So, or close to it, or his father knew your mother. Anyway, the point is, that was always like that, and Jews had a common language. So that's why Jews were successful merchants. And the truth is, some of the popes ultimately had more issues to, and Roman leaders had more issues to worry about than the Jews. The Jews weren't causing troubles. They left them alone, okay, because they had their own issues to worry about. Interestingly, in 1492, when the Jews were expelled from Spain, right, the Gerus Farad, so about 9,000 impoverished Spanish Jews came to the Papal States, came to Rome and the surrounding states, and the Pope then, Alexander VI, welcomed them into Rome, declaring, quote, they're permitted to lead their life free from interference from Christians, to continue in their own rights, to gain wealth, and to enjoy many other privileges. And subsequently, and we know about 1492, but a few years later, the Jews were expelled from Portugal, and part of the same process, and the same thing. What's interesting is, a little bit unfortunate, I guess, to have to bring up, but we have to be honest, okay, there were Jews who were living in Italy, in Rome, who were not happy about these Spanish refugees coming to their land. In fact, some group of Jews asked Alexander to refuse entry to the Spanish Jews, the Muranos. And he was stunned, like, what? How could you do this? Okay, and they were, you know, worried about the money and jobs and everything else. It's very hard. You can take in 9,000 destitute, impoverished people, leave all this stuff behind. It's, you know, but at the end, again, they did, as I said before, they did take in Jews. By doing that, these popes were favorable to the Jews, and, you know, again, violated one of the, you know, most important enactments of Christianity, namely, that Christians shouldn't use Jewish positions and do business with Jews and so on, but, you know, I guess the life of realities of life took over. What changed, a dramatic change, took place in the year... one other interesting thing. One of the things that came up from time to time in Rome, as did throughout Europe, was the so-called blood libel. I think one of the Tisha B'Av maybe spoke about blood libels. Okay, blood libel was that they accused Jews of killing Christian babies in order to use the blood for the baking of the matzah. This is an ancient blood libel, okay, which and there was one in the 1900s, in the famous 1900s in Russia. It's not, you know, I'm sorry? Yeah, so the Talmud wrote the book The Fixer, right? It was a fictional one, but it's a true story. Anyway, so there was a boy, Christian boy, by the name of Simon, who was found in the river, something accused the Jews of killing him to get blood and so on. He became a saint, Saint Simon. Okay, in fact, he was known as the little Saint Simon, the little holy son Simonino, the little holy little Simon. Eventually, in 1961, you know, the problem was the Christian calendar, they had too many days that were saints' days. We know some of them, right? There's St. Patrick and St. Valentine's and St. Whatever, you know, there's different saints' days. And then there's All Saints' Day, right? But so the Vatican cleaned it up a little bit to have, you know, only the people who were actually saints. And one of the people who was eliminated was this St. Simon, because the story was very, very unclear. And the Vatican at that time was asked by this historian, this Simon, Sam Wagoner, asked the Monsignor Frutatz, who was a priest in charge of some things in the Vatican, the historical office, he asked him, he said that actually the Simon was never canonized. Canonized means to be actually declared a saint, okay, and he wasn't actually canonized. And he says, quote, there's such a difference between real saints and who have suffered endlessly for the church and those local or provincial saints whose past is quite obscure. Of course, I presume in the case of Simon of Trent, the story may have been kept alive by the Jews. Right? The Jews had this story about him. Anyway, that's in terms of that. Things changed very dramatically in the 1500s. Okay, and in the year, is that coin still floating around? Okay, you finished it? Okay, thanks. So, something else in the hand grabs. So, Pope Paul IV, okay, issued what's called the papal bull. The word bull there certainly doesn't mean what we use it in slang today. It has nothing to do with the animal either. The word bull means a decree. I think related to the Hebrew word bull, a stamp. You know, the Hebrew word bulim is stamps. Right? It's something that had the official stamp. You know, official gushpanka. You know, right? So the popes would issue these different papal bulls. So in 1555, Pope Paul IV issued first of all, again, he confirmed any past things that were against Jews. He added more oppressive things designed to prevent Jews from being in certain business and certain professions and so on. But in 1555, he issued something called Cum Nimis Absurdum, which was called that based on its opening words, which reads as follows. Since it is absurd and utterly inconvenient that the Jews, who through their own fault were condemned by God to eternal slavery, can, under the pretext that pious Christians must accept them and sustain their habitation, are so ungrateful to Christians, instead of thanks for gracious treatment, they return continual among themselves, instead of the slavery which they deserve, they manage to claim superiority. We, who newly learned that these very Jews have insolently invaded our city, Rome, and a number of the papal states, territories, and domains, their impetus increased so much that they dare not only to live amongst the Christian people, but also in the vicinity of the churches, without any difference of dressing, and even that they rent houses in the main streets and squares, buy and hold immovable property, engage maids, nurses, and other Christian servants, and commit other and numerous misdeeds with shame and contempt of the Christian name, considering that the Church of Rome tolerates these very Jews, evidence of the true Christian faith. And to this end, we declare that they, won over by the piety and kindness of the state, of the Holy See, I'm sorry, it's the Pope, should at long last recognize their erroneous ways and should lose no time in seeing the true light of the Catholic faith, and thus do agree that while they persist in their errors, realizing that they are slaves because of their deeds, whereas Christians have been freed through our Lord God, his name, and then it is iniquitous that it is iniquitous to appear that the sons of free women serve the sons of maids. It's a long sentence, but there is a basically it declares that the Jews are ungrateful. That the Jews, it's ridiculous. It's called communis absurdum because those first words absurd. That the Jews should have rights and so on, and therefore all the rights of the Jewish community were revoked and restricted within the papal states. And perhaps even more dramatically, this was the beginning of what's known as the Jewish ghetto of Rome. And the Jews were confined to be living in only a certain area of Rome. This was a terrible blow. The Jews had to be confined. Like, again, you know, the Germans we know didn't make up ghettos either. But the establishment of the ghetto, the Jews had to be restricted to those areas. That was a result of this papal bull in the 1550s. It's interesting, there's a question, a grammatical question. And sorry, where does the word ghetto come from? It's very unclear where the word ghetto comes from. There are some who actually, I mean, those people who were put in the ghetto, I don't think particularly cared where the word comes from. But just historically, we're looking at where does the word come from. There are those who say that it actually comes from the word get. You know, get, the bill of divorce. It's highly unlikely, I think, but they say it comes from that because you're separated, you're apart from everybody else. Different suggestion, but whatever it is, maybe related to the word gate. You know, the English word gate, you know, fenced in, guarded in, whatever exactly the word comes from. Jews were given very, very little living space. Okay, the whole area was 3 acres in size, and the position was really a terrible position. You had thousands of people living in a very small area. Again, we've seen depictions in the Holocaust and in the ghettos in Germany and the Poland and so on and so forth. But this was a much, much earlier, 4 centuries earlier ghetto. One of the problems of the ghetto. Okay. And by the way, also around the same time, there was another burning of the Talmud. Approximately 2,000 to 3,000 Jews lived in Rome in 1555 when the walled ghetto was put up. Okay, and there were terrible poverty, terribly cramped conditions, and as the population grew, it grew worse. Okay, by the time the ghetto walls were finally opened in the year 1870, when Italy became a unified country, we'll get to that. There were some, you know, around 9,000 or so Jews living in a very, very small area. Jews were allowed to leave the ghetto during the daylight hours, but outside the ghetto they had to wear clothing that identified them as Jews. As I mentioned before, yellow hats at that point, and the two other, and actually the women had to wear 2 blue stripes across their chest, the same thing the prostitutes wore. Okay, that was obviously intended. Okay, and Jews basically had 2 jobs. Okay, money lending and shmata selling, clothing selling, you know, shmata selling. That was the jobs that Jews could do. And, that was about it. Part of the problem in the ghetto, the Roman ghetto, is it was literally right on the banks of the River Tiber, which flows through Rome, of course, to this day. So I'll pass this next thing around, so I'll start on this side. So here, we have two maps. Those my family know I like maps. Okay. Anyway, two maps, one of the old Roman ghetto and one of the afterwards. You can see over here, the house literally went up to the river. Right? That was the old ghetto. Literally went up to the river. Later on, when things were opened up, the whole embankments and trees and things were moved back. When you pass it around, you can kind of look at the ghetto. It's in Italian. The words don't matter. You can see the picture, what it looked like. It was cramped conditions, crowded conditions, and the proximity to the river meant that there was constantly water overflowing everywhere. Anytime it rained, I guess someone's had that problem here too, but anytime it rains, the basements got flooded, the first floor got flooded, and it happened all the time, because you can see in a picture that the houses go right up, mamish, right up to the river. It's not like here, okay, things overflowed and things, so it was a constant, and of course, the water wasn't clean, it wasn't like today, so there was filth, and there was disease, and germs, and it was really kind of to a great extent, a miserable condition, okay. Jews were required as well, living in the ghetto, surrounding the ghetto, you can see, on the other sides of the ghetto are churches. So wherever you go, there's a church. Right? That was also intentional. On one side is the river, and now you have churches almost like at every entryway. The Jews should always see churches, because they were always interested that Jews should convert, and so on. Okay? So, another interesting thing, okay, that was necessary for Jews to do as a result of all of this, was that at least once a week, Jews had to attend lectures on Christianity. Okay, they were forced to go to, they were forced to go to lectures on Christianity. Okay, the churches flanked the ghetto on all sides. Okay, actually, there were records, I'm not going to talk about it halachically now, but some of the women used to take the wax from the Shabbos candles and put it in their ears. I'm not going to talk about helpless muksa now, but that's how they avoided having to listen to these sermons. They clogged up their ears with wax from the Shabbos candles. But they had to go to these lectures, okay? And then, drone on about the Christianity and so on. They did have a shul, but they had to, there was only one shul, which had five different minyanim in it because of different traditions, and all that, have one shul. I just want to read to you an interesting thing. The French philosopher Montaigne gave a description of one of the compulsory sermons he witnessed in Rome in 1580. Okay, he was impressed with the speaker. All right, now the speaker, he writes, was an apostate rabbi. Okay, and he writes there were several learned men in his audience, about 60 people whose beliefs he combated. Speaking in both Hebrew and in Italian, he was quite admirable. Okay, so then sometimes they had good speakers, powerful speakers. As far as the Jews concerned, he went into the shul somehow, and he described what the religious service in the shul looked like. They sing totally discordantly. The way they do, by the way, he says in Calvinist churches, the Reformed church, the Reformation, right? Chanting in the Hebrew pairs with a certain cadence, but in extreme dissonance. They seem to pay, listen to this one, they seem to pay no more attention to their prayers than we do in ours. Nor do they pay great reverence to the mysterious words. Before entering the synagogue, they washed their hands, and once inside, to take off the head covering would be terrible. Right? On their shoulders, on their head, they wear a kind of sheet with fringes attached. It would take too long for me to try and understand why. After the service, the learned men among them explain the part of the Torah that they have read. Then they choose one or more men in the congregation to argue about it. I don't think choose them, but this do. Okay. Anyway, the main speaker we heard seemed to have great eloquence and wisdom. Now, again, so you had these different Jews, but that was in the Jewish school, but anyway, people went and they had to go to these sermons, okay, and I'm reading now from Wagner's own description. The Jews, of course, could hardly be considered obedient and attentive pupils at the Saturday afternoon sessions. They did it on Shabbos, that's when you're free, right? It was supposed to be their day of rest. Instead of being able to take a walk or a nap, they had to sit in a church where from the pulpit an incessant flow of words from an alien theology would pour forth. For some, these words went in one ear and out the other. Others would hold their hands over their ears or stuff them with wax, like we said before. Dozing was not allowed. Okay, and there were people who actually walk up and down the aisle to poke you. Some of the rabbanim should try them. Anyway, the same chastisement was meted out to those Jews who chatted or who yawned out loud. But from the evidence, it appears that the Jews were great at yawning at these sessions and at talking about business, forthcoming marriages, bar mitzvahs, and the like, all subjects considered of far greater importance to them than the words of even the most eloquent priest. The cacophonic obstruction often was such that the priest's words could hardly be understood by the orator himself. Perhaps for the Jews, this was just the effect that they were after. The scene was not without its comic aspect. In the audience, Jews staging a tremendous tumult, talking, gesticulating surreptitiously, putting the wax back into their ears whenever they ordered to remove it. Elsewhere, Jews snoring in unison. In the aisle, official guards dashing up and down, swinging their sticks to enforce theological attention. And up front, the desperate priest trying in vain to make his voice heard above the unceremonious din. So you can imagine what goes on during the rabbi's dress. Just put it together. Okay. Anyway. All right, so this is a little bit the description of these four. But there were these four sermons, okay? And this is not, by the way, wasn't originated necessarily here, but we find that sometimes they made good cases. They were intelligent people often, okay? And actually, one of my sons is working on Rabbeinu Bachir, who is in Spanish, not nothing to do with Italy, but he wrote sort of an encyclopedia of Torah ideas, and according to his point, Rabbeinu Bachir really wrote this as a response. The Jews should know how to respond to certain things, and things should be organized in a certain way. Anyway, it's an interesting point we'll talk about another time. But anyway, that's a little bit about that. Jews had to have permission and paid a yearly tax, so to speak, to have the privilege, so to speak, living in the in the ghetto. And as you know, almost everywhere else in Rome, there was no fresh water. I spoke about the overflowing rivers and so on. So obviously, it was a pretty miserable situation. The Pope assumed that after a couple of years, the Jews will give in. Didn't know how stubborn Jews are. And the truth is, we're called Am Kshei Orif, a stiff-necked people. Stiff-necked people sometimes is a positive. You know, it's much easier to write something in sand, to carve something in sand, than to carve it in concrete. The only thing is, when you carve it in concrete, it lasts. And the sand doesn't last, right? So, in Jewish people, again, he thought the Jews would kind of give in and convert. And there certainly were, no doubt about it. Okay, there were Jews who converted to Christianity, but at the same time, many did not. And you know, there are records in taking children and baptizing them. Okay, we won't go into that now. We'll save a few moments. The first reprieve from the terrors of the ghetto came when Napoleon, in the late 1700s, conquered Europe, including Italy. He's from Italy himself originally. Okay, Bonaparte is an Italian name. Anyway, basically, he was, as a general rule, we won't talk about Napoleon now, but a general rule, Napoleon was favorable to the Jews. And he, as much, you know, for two reasons, that he released the Jews from some of their obligations. First of all, it was a way of being kind to the Jews, which he was interested in doing because he wanted their support. But it was also a way of stuffing the Pope, right, to show that I'm in charge. In fact, the truth is, you know, when Charlemagne, the great French emperor before the year 1000, when he became king, it's a famous thing. The Pope came with the crown and placed the crown on Charlemagne's head and crowned him king, you know, as if to say, well, it's because I'm crowning you. I'm God's representative. I'm crowning you. When Napoleon became the king and the Pope wore him the crown, he took it and put it on his own head. You know, subtle, or not so subtle, gesture that he's in charge. Anyway, so under Napoleon, things improved. The papal states were initially dissolved. Again, it was temporary. Actually, Napoleon convened what's called the French Sanhedrin, if you've ever heard that term. Not a halachic Sanhedrin, but it was rabbis, including from Italy. They sent representatives to figure out and determine certain laws for the Jews. Again, it's a fascinating subject for another time. But in any event, for a while, under Napoleon, things were better for the Jews of Rome. Just to read. All right, in the 1800s, the mid 1800s, you had all over Europe, including eventually in Italy, unifying to single countries. Most of Europe, much of Europe, Germany was certainly like that. There was no country called Germany. No country. The land was there. There was no country called Germany. It was a lot of different. I don't know what you call that. Feudalism, so it was feudal lords, but a lot of different dukes and whatever you call them, who controlled particular areas, and it wasn't a unified country. All right, same thing with Italy, but there's all these little different city-states, as it were. In the 1840s, there was an interest in Italy also to unify the country. It didn't happen yet in 1840, but one of the Roman leaders, Massimo da Zeglio, in 1848, said, "Let us extend our hands to our Jewish brothers and repair the damage caused by the outrageous insults they had to endure from those who do not merit the name Christians. Okay, so he was favorable to Jews. Again, it didn't happen in 1848. Okay, the Papal States came back. But in 1870, finally, Rome was taken over, and ending the reign of the popes in Rome. He became the king, Victor Emmanuel II. That's one of the main streets there in Rome. It's called Victor Emmanuel Street. Anyway, the Papal State ceased to exist on September 20th, 1870, when they became part of the rest of the country, and the ghetto walls were eventually torn down. And that's really when Jews in the 1870 became more, you know, more accepted and more, freer than before. In fact, moving into the 20th century, as we have to wind down, it was in 1904 that the Great Synagogue of Rome, which is there and go to, was built, a magnificent synagogue. And, you know, earlier, as I said before, embankments had been built. They're passing the map around, but we'll see it, you know, that made it more okay for Jews to live there. We'll come back to what happened to that area, because now it's a very chic area. That area, they got nice restaurants there and so on, good ice cream. Anyway, in 1910, Italian Prime Minister was named Luigi Luzzatti, who was Jewish. So he had one of the first heads of government, who was Jewish, who had not converted to Christianity. Okay, and by 1902, out of 350 senators in the Roman Senate, there were 6 Jews. And by 1920, there were 19 Jews. So you can see that Jews did have, you know, increasing influence. It was around that time also that one of the popes gave access to the Jews to go into the Vatican to look at certain things and so on. And he spoke about the good anti-Semitism as opposed to bad anti-Semitism. For another time as well. In World War I, many Jews fought on the Italian side. In World War I, okay, about 5,000 Jews joined the army. 420 were killed in action during the war. So Jews certainly were part of the Italian scene, part of the Roman scene, and things were reasonably good or better. However, when the fascist government of Mussolini took over, so actually many Jews in the early 1920s did support Mussolini. Okay, there were Jews who marched in the famous march of October 1922, the so-called March on Rome, that brought Mussolini's party into power. And there are many Jews who joined that. However, when Mussolini eventually joined forces with Hitler, so in the late 1930s, they're called Jewish racist laws, national racist laws, or racial laws were passed, and that was again similar to the racial laws of Nuremberg and so on. That was once again trouble for the Jews. But for a while, anyway, things worked out reasonably well. As a matter of fact, before that, In 1934, Jabotinsky, the famous Zionist leader, worked with Mussolini to set up a naval officer training camp in the city of Svetovia. That's where all the cruise ships depart from. You're leaving from Rome. It's about an hour from 45 minutes from Rome. And that was the beginning of the Israeli Navy. It was right there in Italy. Jabotinsky set that up. And by helping the Zionist cause, Mussolini hoped that, you know, he would get influence in the Middle East against his enemy, the British, who then controlled. Right? So everything is politics. On the 28th of July, 1938, Pope Pius XI made a speech where he said, we believe in a single race, no special race, and so on. And he writes, mark well that in the Catholic Mass, Abraham is our patriarch and forefather. Anti-Semitism is incompatible with the lofty thought which that fact which we express. It is a movement which we Christians can have nothing to do with. No, I say to you that it is impossible for a Christian to take part in anti-Semitism. It is inadmissible. Through their God, we are the spiritual progeny of Abraham. Spiritually, we are all Semites. Nonetheless, these racial laws were passed. But eventually, as you know, Italy changed sides in World War II. Okay, and eventually the Germans came into Italy, and of course that was not a positive thing for the Jews of Italy. The Nazi occupied Rome in September 1943. At that time, there were 8,000 Jews living in Rome. Many of them actually had moved to Rome from the north, because the north was closer to the main body of Europe, was under Nazi control. October 16th, 1943, a day of infamy for Roman Jews. It was a rainy Shabbos morning. At 5 o'clock in the morning, Nazis came to the doors of the Jewish homes and handed over a note saying that the Jews had 20 minutes to prepare their luggage. Everyone was to go, including women, children, and the aged. Okay, Nazis took over 1,000 Jews that day. 272 were younger than 15, and more than 100 were younger than 5. Many were taken to Auschwitz. 16 would come back. Okay. There were Christians in Rome who helped hide the Jews, who hid Jews in churches and in their homes and so on. Again, there are various different numbers of what the Nazis were able to accomplish. It's estimated that altogether about 10,000 Italian Jews, not just Rome, but 10,000 Italian Jews were deported to concentration and death camps, of whom 7,700 perished. Okay, out of a pre-war Jewish population that amounted to 58,500, okay, the surviving about 12,000, including many who had converted, remained afterwards. Okay, interestingly, the person named Israel Zola, who had been the rabbi in Rome, the chief rabbi of Rome, in 1945, converted, become a Christian. So that's an overview, a little bit, of the history of the Jews of Rome. Now, it's important to recognize, very important to recognize, that the Jews were a theological problem for the Catholic Church. The Jews were a theological problem because they rejected their God, and therefore, as a result, they were condemned for suffer and to wander and to be persecuted and so on. That's a punishment. And that is why you cannot really, I'm not talking from a moral perspective, but you cannot really blame those popes and those people we learned a little bit about today for feeling the way they did about the Jews. They felt that this is what's supposed to happen to them. This is an example of what happens if you reject their God. It's simple as that. Others, as I said before, had other considerations to concern themselves with. They didn't bother with the Jews. Others felt that moral obligations and, you know, Christian love and our common Semitic ancestry and so on outweighed that. Okay, but, you know, before we have to understand that it was a theological issue. Another major theological issue that we should call our attention to is the establishment in 1948 of the State of Israel. How can you have a Jewish homeland? That was against what they believed in. And this is why the Vatican and the Pope did not recognize, initially, the State of Israel. They couldn't. It was a theological problem. The Jews cannot have their own state. They cannot have their own country. Well, they came to terms with that because, well, they didn't have control over Jerusalem. That's where everything is, right? The Arabs still controlled most of the holy place after 1948 till 1967. So the old city and the churches there and so on were under Arab control, okay, not under Jewish control. Okay, so that was a teretz to have a land, but it's still okay. We can recognize the land, but without them having it. Okay, that became a problem after the Six-Day War in 1967, which is when the idea promulgated by the Vatican was that Jerusalem should be an international city. That's exactly the point. Not going to be under Jewish control. Okay, it's going to be an international city, which is, I think, still officially the position today. I don't know for sure, but that's how it is. It's interesting that when Pope John Paul II went to the Holy Land, it was the first pope to come to the State of Israel. This is in March of 2000, and that tipped my son off the sentence to me. He writes, this is the note, apparently, that he put in at the Kol Samaravi. God of our fathers, who chose Abraham and his descendants to bring your name to the nations, we are deeply saddened by the behavior of those who in the course of history have caused these children of yours to suffer. And asking your forgiveness, we wish to commit ourselves to genuine brotherhood with the people of the covenant. Okay, that was what he put in at the Kol Samaravi. And, just a moment. And the Yad Vashem, he wrote, as Bishop of Rome, that's the official title of the Pope, it's called the Bishop of Rome, as Bishop of Rome and successor to the Apostle Peter, I assure the Jewish people that the Catholic Church, motivated by the gospel law of truth and love and by no political consideration, is deeply saddened by the hatred, acts of persecution, and displays of anti-Semitism directed against Jews by Christians at any time and in any place. The Church rejects racism in any form as a denial of the image of the Creator inherent in every human being. In this place of solemn remembrance, again, it's Yad Vashem, in this place of solemn remembrance, I fervently pray that our sorrow for the tragedy which the Jewish people suffered in the 20th century will lead to a new relationship between Christians and Jews. Let us, and there's a lot of literature about what the Pope, not him, but the previous Pope could have or didn't do during the Holocaust. The discussion we'll talk about popes another time. But anyway, let us build a new future in which there will be no more anti-Jewish feeling among Christians or any or anti-Christians among Jews, but rather the mutual respect required of those who adore the one Creator and Lord and look to Abraham as our common father in faith. The world must heed the warning that comes to us from the victims of the Holocaust and from the testimony of these survivors. Here at Yad Vashem, the memory lives on and burns itself into our souls. It makes us cry out. I hear the whispering of many terror on every side, but I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. That's from Tillem. Okay, now, just to conclude, Jewish Rome today. Jewish Rome today. So there are Jews living in Rome today. The old ghetto area is sort of like, in some ways, like the Lower East Side. You know, that's where the Jews used to live. And now it's I don't know too much about the Lower East Side today, but maybe certain parts of the book, I don't know. Where, you know, this is where the Jews used to live, and now you have restaurants there, and, you know, it's become the center, it's become gentrified, the area. That's the best way I can put it. And there are kosher restaurants on the prop Pashkocha and ice cream shops and so on. And it's visited today, okay? There are apartments there sell, according to the information I have, for over €1 million. Okay, it's a desirable area. Many Jews don't live there. Many Jews move to other neighborhoods, right? But it's become a gentrified area. And, you know, Rome's Jewish community really is based in other areas. Of course, there's Chabad now in Rome and so on. And there's been a revival of Jewish interests and Jewish life in Rome today. I just want to end off by saying that talking in the shul, so there is, we know about Ashkenazim and Sfardim. There is another Nusach called Nusach B'nai Romi. Not Ashkenazi, not Sfardim. Many things are the same, obviously overlap, but they have their own Nusach. Sometimes they're called the Talk. If you look every once in a while, I think even in the art school, Chumash, the Haftorahs, you know, the Ashkenazim read this, the Sfardim, the Italians stop here, the Italians start there, whatever. So they refer to the time, but really it's Nusach B'nai Romi. And they're proud of their Nusach and so on. And it has certain specific things, certain specific minhagim and certain things. I just mentioned one minhag which I came across, which I mentioned in the kinnis this morning. Of course, like all of us, the Jews of Rome read Eicha on Tisha B'Av night. But they read it in the dark, holding long candles. I hear we dim the lights, but I'm saying with electric lights, but they read it holding long candles. And, you know, that's how they read the Megillas Eicha, to the light of long candles. When Eicha is over, they blow out the candles, and they use those the following Chanukah to light the menorah. Fascinating. Fascinating minute, no? It's, you know, that even in the time of Velus, we look forward to the redemption. The menorah represents the redemption. The menorah represents in the Arch of Titus, the menorah represents, you know, taking away the menorah. But the menorah also represents, like we say in Mo's Tzur, we light the menorah, we're saying, Ozegmor, B'shir Mizmor, it's projecting the future. We're going to one day finish this all. We're going to finish this dedication the Chashmonaim started. So there's a lot to say about that. It's not necessarily for Tishba, but you get the idea. I'll just end off by somebody, and I don't know who said this, I can't quote it, but it's very similar to what our guide said when we were by the Arch of Titus. As I stood at the Arch of Titus, I had an imaginary conversation with that ancient emperor. Titus, 2,000 years after your troops carried off the menorah, it's back. There's a replica of that menorah in front of the Knesset, the Jewish parliament. We're back. We won. The Romans tortured and killed 10 Jewish sages. We mentioned the Asarag HaMalchus this morning in the Kinnis. We read their stories on Tishra and Yom Kippur. Their words survived. The words of those rabbis survived the Roman Empire and every subsequent empire. We won. Rabbi Akiva was the greatest of those martyred sages. He was probably one of the greatest sages who ever lived. Okay? But I went into his business as a rabbi. Again, I'm not sure who wrote this. I teach his words regularly. We won. When the Romans wrapped another sage, Rechonana ben Chadion, again one of the Asurah Gamalchos, in a Torah scroll and burnt them at the stake, he consoled the students. The scroll is burning, but the letters are returning to God who gave them. That's resurrection. Torah is the piece of us that neither water, nor fire, nor tyrant, nor even assimilation of secularism can destroy. We won. And that's why this guide told us by the Arch of Titus that many people, including myself, like you get teary-eyed, you weep, this is the Arch of Titus, this is the Churban. He said when he's there, of course he's momentarily weak, but then he smiles. Here we are looking at it. And the direction you face happens to, when he likes to look at it, the directions we're facing Mizrach, we're facing towards Eretz Yisrael, that we have Eretz Yisrael. Leo Tolstoy, the famous Russian and Jewish writer, the quote, you've probably heard this before, the Jew is the emblem of eternity. Before I read that, I want to read one other thing. I'm sorry. One of the things that this guy Wagoner concludes with. He says a personal story. He said he was in Rome with this. We'll finish. I'm sorry for going a few minutes over. He said he saw this himself. Same day in front of a building, a Roman father with his son, perhaps Jewish, perhaps not, I have no idea, were reading on the inscription on the stone embedded in the wall of the synagogue commemorating the 6 million Jews who died during the last World War, the more than 8,000 who were deported from Italy. We mentioned the numbers before. After a while, they slowly walked over to the other stone slab and the names of 71 Jews who were shot somewhere else mentioned and so on and so forth. Interrupting the silent contemplation, again, this person was an eyewitness, the boy turned to his father and he asked, "How long have the Jews been in Rome?" The father took his eyes away from the wall. He took the boy by the hand and began to walk off in the direction of the bridge, but I was able to hear his answer from a distance. "Son," he said, with a kind of rhetorical certitude that had more than a grain of truth in it, "son, there have always been Jews in Rome." And Tolstoy wrote, "The Jew is the emblem of eternity, he whom neither slaughter nor torture nor thousands of years could destroy, he whom neither fire nor swords nor inquisition was able to wipe off the face of the earth, he who was the first to produce the oracles of God, he who has been for so long the guardian of prophecy, the pioneer of liberty, and the creator of true civilization, and who transmitted all these to the rest of the world. Such a nation cannot be destroyed. The Jew is as everlasting as eternity itself." And Jews in Rome were there for an awfully long time, and are still there, and it's worth visiting. Yeah.